Hello, McLean Johnson here. Welcome to a special edition of the Sunday Jam podcast. I recently had the pleasure of interviewing Kirk West. And Kirk West is the founder of the Big House Foundation. The Big House Foundation is dedicated to opening a museum in honor of the Allman Brothers Band in Macon, Georgia. And the museum is going to be housed in the Big House, which is where the Allman Brothers lived from 1971 to 1973, and wrote many other classic songs, including Ramblin' Man. And Kirk West has been a part and friend of the Allman Brothers organization for many years. He started off shooting photos of the band, and then he became the band's tour manager, and eventually he ended up buying the Big House, and then decided to turn it into a museum. If you enjoy the podcast, please check out past episodes at sundayjam.podomatic.com.
How did the idea for the Allman Brothers Band Museum first come together?
Well, you know, the Big House, my wife and I bought the Big House in 1993. Mm-hmm. I was the assistant tour manager of the Allman Brothers at the time, and we were living in Chicago, and the Big House that they lived in the 70s, 70 to 73, was a private home. Yeah, they didn't own the house back in the 70s. They just leased it, had a lease on it. And when they moved out in 73, from 73 to 93, when we bought it and moved in, it was just a private home owned by a series of people that somebody ran a beauty parlor in one of the part of the house. And somebody ran a law office out of it. But primarily it was a private home. And we bought it with the idea of kind of doing a bed and breakfast. And I had amassed a fairly extensive collection of memorabilia and posters and photographs and tapes and stuff. And so we thought it would be an interesting little diversion for a few years. Opened kind of a rock and roll bed and breakfast. In the house that the Allman Brothers used to live in. So we bought the house and moved down from Chicago, and the problem was is that the building codes and zoning ordinances in the city of Macon essentially prohibit your traditional bed and breakfast kind of business. So we couldn't run a bed and breakfast, but we had set up a couple of the rooms on the on the main floor to be the museum rooms. And so we just kind of had this casual open door policy with the world that you were welcome to knock on the door anytime you wanted, provided you could take no for an answer, you know. Uh-huh. And we didn't have hours and we didn't charge admission. I was on the road a lot. My wife was there all the time, and we had we were publishing a little quarterly publication, a little magazine called Hitting the Note. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so there was a lot of activity in the house. It's 6,000 square feet and on a nice big piece of property in a historic district in Macon. And so we just kind of, you know, we lived there 14 years from 93 to 2007. And in that time, we had between 20 and 25,000 people knock on the door. So, yeah. You know, it kind of became tiresome mm-hmm. to be living there and having that kind of flow. You know, mm-hmm. We didn't ever do a bed and breakfast, but what we did do was all the band came back and stayed. Sometimes two or three times. Government Mule, Warren and Alan and Matt moved in and created Government Mule in the house. They had this idea, and we cleaned out the archive rooms, and they set up in the very room that the Allmans used to rehearse in when they lived there. And Warren slept in Dwayne's old room, and Woody slept in Barry's old bedroom. And you know, so the three of them and their roadie set up in there and worked for 10-12 days working up all their first set of songs and material, and and played their very first gig downtown at a club downtown. And so, you know, that's kind of the way it all unfolded. And then we, in about 2005 or 4, I guess it was about 2004, we realized that we had to do something different than living the way we had been. And so started looking around for somebody to basically take over.
Mm-hmm.
We had moved the businesses out of the house and moved them. We bought the house next door, which was an old Victorian house on the corner right next door to the big house. And so we had these two houses, and we were running our business out of the house next door. And so we had kind of calmed down the chaos in the big house, but we still had all the pilgrims showing up. So we thought, well, let's see what we can do. So we tried to find somebody that was just as wacky as we were to let some strangers wander through your house. We couldn't really find the right combination of heart and spirit and intention and bank account. What we did was we formed a foundation, a 501c3 tax-exempt foundation, and built a board of directors from around the country, Allman Brothers fans from around the country and here in Macon, and started raising money. And in 2007, the foundation took over the house and the collection, which is a massive collection of memorabilia. Mm-hmm.
Do you have a favorite piece of memorabilia in the collection?
Oh, that's hard, man. No, there's 200,000 pieces. That's tough to be married to one. There's a couple really cool pieces. There's the case from the cover of the Fillmore East album.
That's awesome.
Stenciled. And we've got a Dwayne leather jacket, and we've got a satin tie-dyed shirt, purple and gold, that Clapton had given Dwayne when they were doing Layla. And you know, but then there's, you know, there's handwritten lyrics to Blue Sky, you know. You know, there's all kinds of stuff. It's very tough, you know. You know, so it's cool.
How did you first become involved with managing the Allman Brothers?
Well, I'm the road manager, not the manager. I'm the guy that makes sure they get to point A and point B on time. I was just, you know, I was a fan from the beginning. I heard the first album and was a fan, and lived as a, I was living as a hippie in those early years, just floating around and doing whatever it took to get to the next show. And then as I got older and the band got more successful, my spiral went down, their spiral went up, and then we kind of converged in the middle, and my downward trajectory kind of started going up, and their trajectory started heading down a bit. And so I was a photographer doing album covers, and I was living in Chicago and doing tour photography and album covers and public relations stuff. And in the mid to later 70s, we became friends, and I was just around, you know. Nobody hires a photographer full time, so I'd go out for 3 or 4 weeks on the road with him, shoot pictures, and then come back to Chicago and shoot blues, or go out with Willie Nelson or The Clash or somebody like that. But these guys were my friends, and that was my favorite music. And so, you know, it was, when they broke up the second time in 1982, and I was working on a little project at the time, trying to put together a coffee table book of my photography and some earlier time period of photography of the band. And it just kind of unfolded, and so I started gathering material for this book project. It kind of grew into a biography project. I started doing interviews and gathering serious research material throughout the South, going from one of their houses to the next, staying at Dickie's or going to Mama A's or stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And the biography or the photo, the coffee table book never happened. But what did happen was across the along the way, I ran across a vast amount of audio tape. Mm-hmm. There was, because the band had fragmented and broken up two different times, there was no central archive. There was no central housing of band material and property. When they fragment, people would take their stuff and put it in the garage and, mm-hmm. and move on to the next project, you know. So there wasn't like a Grateful Dead archive, you know, or in modern-day times, you know, somebody like Fish or something. And then Capricorn went bankrupt about the time they broke up the second time, so that all those tapes that were housed at the Capricorn studio were moved to Polygram's tape vault up in New Jersey and another one in New York. So everything got scattered. So throughout the mid-'80s, and I was gathering, I would copy everything that I found. And so in 88... In 88, Polygram, a fellow by the name of Bill Levinson that worked for Polygram Records, did the Eric Clapton Crossroads box set. Mm-hmm. And it was a huge success. And it was something that hadn't really happened before. There had been, you know, box sets of albums for jazz or classical music mm-hmm. and stuff, but there had never really been a rock box, you know. Rock wasn't that old, you know, to do a career retrospective at those times. But this was a CD release and also vinyl and cassette, but it was a huge success. Sold a couple million units, and that was massive. So Polygram also had control of the vast amount of Allman Brothers material. They took over the Capricorn catalog. Mm-hmm. So Levinson, Bill, was a big Allman Brothers fan, and so he thought the next natural thing to do after Clapton was the Allman Brothers. And so he started to research and look into, and everybody he asked said, well, you need to talk to Kirk West. Mm-hmm. He knows where all the tapes are. He's been digging around.
Because you had copied everything, right?
Yeah, because I knew where it all was, you know. And they knew what was on the shelves, or they thought they knew. So I got involved in that thing and worked for about a year with Bill on it, and it came out in the spring of 89, mm-hmm. and it was the 20th anniversary of the Allman Brothers, and so Dickie had a solo deal with his band, and Greg had a solo deal with his band. They both happened to be on Epic Records, and Epic thought that it would be good business if they put the Allman Brothers back together, and so the brothers thought, well, let's see. Let's not sign a deal yet. Let's go out there and see if we can play together and tour behind this archive, this box set release. And that was in the spring of 89, and they've been together ever since. So, and I went out as a photographer, and then they had a tour manager that was not communicating with them very well, so they hired me to be his assistant so that I could speak for him to them. And they got rid of him, and I stayed on as that. And so, you know, it's been an interesting 20 years.
It's amazing to go from a fan to being a tour manager.
Oh, yeah. No, it's been an interesting, long, straight trip, brother.
Do you have a favorite memory from being on the road with the Allmans?
Well, there's been so many, man. I mean, there's been so many great high moments. It's been, I think, one of the earliest overwhelming nights was in July of 91. This was the band's, that current configuration's first tour of Europe. And we played a joint in Paris called La Cigale. And the band played so well, and the audience was so intense. It wasn't that big a place, maybe 3,000-seater, you know. It was a ballroom kind of thing like the old Fillmore was, and yet the intensity and the level of playing and the audience was just incredible. It was one of the highlights. And there have been so many others, you know, since then. I mean, there's been tremendous shows, good moments, and you know, one night in particular, the Beacon runs are always unbelievable. Some better than others. This past one was just, you know, I don't think we'll ever top it. Those nights with Clapton were really beyond belief. There was one night after a Beacon show that Dickie and his wife and Greg and his wife and me and my wife took a car up to the Apollo in Harlem, and B.B. King and Bobby Blue Bland were playing that night, and sitting in the dressing room with all those characters was,
yeah,
was a great night too, you know. So I've been blessed. I've been lucky, you know.
What do you think is the biggest misconception about the Allman Brothers?
That they like the term Southern Rock.
Nice.
You know? They never set out to do anything at all like that. They set out to create some music, and somebody, some record reviewer or publicity promotion guy came up with that term, and they've chafed at that, you know, for a long, long time, you know. You know, they created a style and a sense of playing and music that hasn't been, it's a unique deal. And, you know, it's easy to distill it down to lowest common denominator kind of thing, but, you know, they're proud of what they've achieved, I know that.
That was Kirk West from the Big House Foundation. They were creating the Allman Brothers Band Museum. More information on them, please check out thebighousemuseum.com. Once again, I'm McLean Johnson. This has been a special edition of the Sunday Jam Podcast.